listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, a podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. I'm your host, Noah Larracy. Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hello, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral and cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. And today we're recording from San Francisco, where we're attending IOCDF, or the International OCD Foundation Conference. And we are very excited to have Dr. Reed Wilson as our special guest.
Hello.
Reed Wilson is the director of the Anxiety Disorders Treatment Center in Chapel Hill in Durham, North Carolina, and is adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at the North Carolina School of Medicine. He is the author of the best-selling classic Don't Panic, and his latest book is called Stopping the Noise in Your Head, The New Way to Overcome Anxiety and Worry. Dr. Wilson, why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with IOCDF and how you came to be involved?
Well, I really got in this field long ago, working in panic and trying to figure all that out. I had a relationship over time with Dr. Edna Foa, and she and I decided to write a self-help book called Stop Obsessing. So that really got me more deeply involved with OCD work. So now I treat all the anxiety disorders, but actually, pardon the expression of being favorite, but OCD is really my favorite treatment protocol right now.
And OCD is kind of like the mother of all anxiety disorders, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sorry they took OCD out of the umbrella of anxiety disorders, because I think they should bring it back. I think there's common denominators among all the anxiety disorders and OCD. And most importantly, they all face the same challenger. You know, I'm not a splitter, I'm a clumper. And I think there's a lot that we can say that is broad and general and applies to treatment of all these disorders.
Well, what are some of those principles that you apply generally?
Well, I think the very first thing that we want to do is to get some perspective. What I talk about is just stepping back. You know, there's a few ways to step back. You gotta step back to go, wait a minute. I say this to people all the time. You have a mental health disorder, and you get all caught up, for instance, with OCD around the content, or the claustrophobic who thinks they're gonna suffocate on the plane and so forth. Those topical areas are how the disorder runs you. And if you can step back and go, wait a minute, I'm getting run by this disorder. That's the first part of stepping back. And the second is, like, in the moment, to be able to step back. And I know you've talked about mindfulness in the past, and that's certainly that kind of mindful step. So that if you don't step back, nothing else happens. And I got three of the things that I do, and maybe we'll talk about it as we go along, which is the most provocative, I think, is the idea of wanting what you're experiencing, which is a hard sell for people, but yeah, immensely helpful therapeutically.
Why would that be helpful? I mean, I'm just playing the devil's advocate here. Most people, if they have a fear, basically avoid it, right? I mean, if I'm afraid of earthquakes, I wouldn't be living in California, right?
Well, I don't know. You could live in California and be in fear.
Okay.
So, exactly. And that's such an interesting thing about the anxiety disorders. And of course, I would say Dr. Yip and I have known each other for years, and I have tremendous respect for you. So thank you for letting me talk with you today. But that's the whole thing. The anxiety disorders take advantage of Mother Nature. This is so understandable that we respond in the way we do. If you come across a snake in the driveway, you're going to jump and squeal like a little child, perhaps. And then for the next few days, every stick is a snake, every garden hose is a snake, every leash on the ground is a snake. We're trained to respond like that. The disorders take advantage of that basic nature.
I know you have your ways of talking people into wanting what they don't want. So, what are some of those ways that you can convince our audience to want what they fear?
I know, and it is, you know, I talk about it all the time as persuasive therapy. My job is to change your mind. The disorders tend to dominate your mind, and so people go up and are checking things all the time in their head to see if it's the right thing to do. First off, around wanting it. It is the opposite of what the disorder requires. The disorder gives you sensations, gives you fearful thoughts, and requires you to try to push them away. And as long as it can get you to try to avoid it, close it down, mute the symptoms, it's got control of you. So we want to understand if that's its game, we need to reverse that in some way. There's tremendous stuff to be thinking about both in the amygdala and what hardly anybody talks about, which I think we should talk about, is the working memory that really takes advantage of our neurology and our brain to get us to do what we want to do. And I think the other thing around wanting it, I got to have an outcome picture that's important to me, that is larger than my fear. If I want that outcome picture and I can trust that the protocol to get me better is going to move me toward that outcome picture, well, then I don't like doing exposure. I don't like having to be anxious and uncomfortable, but I want that outcome. And so I want what I need to do to get better. I'll say one of the couple of things about that. I try not to use the word better anymore. I'm trying to say to get stronger. And I don't remember what the second thing was, so it's okay.
It's all right, because you brought something up. You brought up the amygdala, and I don't know that our audience would understand what that is. So can you explore that a little bit more?
Oh, sure. Our amygdala is our panic button. It's the part of us, if you hit ice around here in L.A., for instance, while you're driving, and it's the one that saves your life, your conscious mind turns to mush, but your amygdala takes in data from the thalamus and sends a message to the hypothalamus, and then it sends a message to the adrenal glands, and it says secrete some epinephrine because there's an emergency right now. It is what is built into our nature to save us, and that's where the disorders go. If you're going to try to get over, let's say, the fear of elevators, there's two ways to go. You can step on the elevator and try to do the practice your therapist tells you to do to get over it and so forth. And then you get in the elevator and the door closes and you're going up three flights. And if you are at the same moment saying, oh my gosh, I hope that door opens. What if the cable breaks? If you start saying all those things in your head while you're doing the exposure, there is no benefit to that exposure. It will do nothing because you're scaring yourself again and your amygdala comes in and says, I'll save you, Nell. And I talk about self-talk all the time. If you're going to do that practice, you basically want to be going, I want to do this. This is going to be helpful to me. I don't like it, but I want it. Foa and Kozak back in 1986 wrote an article that's the most cited article in psychology, and they talked about the fear structure. So you come across that snake in the sidewalk, you instantly create a fear structure of being afraid of snakes and sidewalks and so forth, or elevators, as we talk about it. We really want to go in neurologically, stimulate the distress that's associated with that trauma in order to modify it. So I actually want to get scared as I face this threat, so I can then say, I can handle this. This is okay. I want to do this, and begin to modify that amygdala so it quiets down over time. That's really our goal.
So if a patient comes to you, and it's obviously been a big step for them to even walk in your office, and they want to change, but they don't want to do the exposures, what are the steps that you do to kind of get them ready to do that work?
Yeah, I was actually thinking that too. What you're saying is great in theory. However, there's always that patient who comes in and wants to do the work. However, I'm afraid to. And then they might try to do the exposures. And then mentally, they're thinking, oh, that's not going to hurt me. That's not going to hurt me. That's not going to hurt me. So they're reassuring themselves mentally. How can the person combat that? How can you help them change their mind? How can you persuade them to think differently so that they can engage in that exposure fully?
Yeah, and I think that's what we're talking about here in this persuasion. I mean, I have a whole list of things I will do with them to continue to talk about. I want to talk about the amygdala, have them understand. I want to make sure they have an outcome picture that's important to them. If they don't, then, you know, why are you here? But you're absolutely right. Our clients and our patients come in and saying, I want that. I want that outcome. I don't want this. I don't want this.
I'm not willing to do
experience, right? And so it is why they pay us the big bucks to try to help them have that experience. But that's also what we want you to talk about. It's like that dynamic has to change. And I'm willing to talk to you and give you some ideas about how to do that. But in the end, you have to decide that. I talked to parents last night who have a 13-year-old who is afraid to fly, and the family's going to Europe, and the boy doesn't want to be on the plane. And so how are we going to get him on the plane? Well, that's a problem because we don't have a client. The son is not interested in flying. You know, and sometimes I'll do imagery with people, you know, what I call success imagery. Let's talk about what skills you think you might need, for instance, with this boy, to manage the plane if you flew there. And then let's try that out in imagery, because in imagery, you can master anything, right? But the trick around imagery is when we try on those skills, what I say is let them work perfectly. Let them help you manage the fear and the distress in the moment. Because if we say, see how well those skills work, they never work in fantasy, because all these disorders are disorders of uncertainty. So you just have to do it in that direction. That whole idea of uncertainty is the other piece. These are disorders of uncertainty. So even though you can sit in the room here and we can map out what you think you need to do regarding your exposure for whatever your anxiety is, and you need to know the closer you get to that event, the other side of you, not the one that's strategizing and thinking and figuring out, the part of you that's going to have to face the event is a younger part of you, so to speak, a weaker part of you, a part of you that feels like you don't have resources. And that part of you is going to go, this seems like a really bad idea to be doing this. I want to work with people to develop. They already got one voice, and I want to help them develop a second voice, which is that therapeutic voice, more or less. And many of them have it, but they argue with themselves about it. And I try to convey to them, you actually have to elevate that therapeutic voice. The part of you is going to be scared, and it is coming with us. And you got to help find a voice inside you that says, and I'm willing to do this, and I want to do this.
When you just said that, I had the image of the devil and an angel on your shoulders, and they're kind of arguing back and forth, and they're chattering up in your mind. And I guess what you're saying is we have to find some way to elevate that voice off the angel, who will compel you to actually want this change, because otherwise the devil wins.
Yeah, I mean, Lieber, right, wrote about the imp of the mind, you know, so you got this little imp. These disorders are clever and conniving, and we have to put them in their place. And they are going after the scared part of us, and we can take care of ourselves. We can develop skills to manage the part of us that feels intimidated, scared, embarrassed. And I'll digress for a minute to say something about what happens a lot with people with social anxiety is, I mean, people with social anxiety are people who are afraid of the critical eye of others. They'll be judging me and so forth. And so often therapists work doing exposures with people to expose themselves to other people maybe making judgments of them. I don't think that's the work. I think the work is to expose myself to the shame that comes up then, the embarrassment that comes up, the humiliation that comes up. That's what we need to focus on. I can have those feelings. They are coming. I will learn to tolerate them. They're not going to go away, because the strategy of trying to get rid of symptoms is exactly opposite of what we want to do. If you try to get rid of these feelings, then so often the best way to get rid of these kind of feelings is do nothing. Then you can feel relatively comfortable, but your life gets really small. And that's why I think people come into treatment, is their life has become so small and they don't like that anymore.
So that all makes a lot of sense. You mentioned a couple of things of why we would want what we are afraid of.
Crazy as that sounds, you know.
I know it is. It is very crazy because I'm playing the devil's advocate. We talked about cooling the amygdala down, and we talked about pushing the disorder to a place of uncertainty. Why else would I want what I'm afraid of?
I know. Crazy. So, but we talked about outcome picture. I want that outcome picture. And if that outcome picture is important to me and this is going to get me there, then I want to do what it takes to get there. We talked about the amygdala, we got to get the amygdala to go, oh, you don't need me to juice you up? Okay, I'll start quieting down. So we want to be working on the amygdala that way. We talked about you want to do the opposite of what the disorder needs you to do. So we got that piece. The other thing neurologically that I think is very important for people to understand is what we call the working memory. And this is absolutely clearly within the science of neurology. And the working memory is what we hold on to at any moment. And so we can hold on to about four chunks of information at any one moment. I'm, you know, thinking about what my next sentence is, and I'm paying attention to a view, and maybe I feel a little perspiration from doing this work and so forth. And we want to take advantage of the working memory. It has three components. Got the what we call the phonological loop, and the visual spatial sketchpad is our imagery. Phonologic loop is us talking to ourselves, and then right in the middle is the central executive. And its job is to screen in the things that we want and screen out the things that aren't helpful. So if I am approaching a threatening situation and I am saying, oh no, I don't really want to be doing this. My therapist says I should do this exposure. Oh no, I've got to do it for 15 minutes. I hate this. I wish I weren't doing it. We are telling the working memory to go back in long-term memory and grab resources for avoidance and fear. So we have to be very clear that you're back in the 70s, we used to say, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. And that was about the Vietnam War. It's like, you can't be quiet. So we need to understand there is no neutrality when you have an anxiety disorder. If you're not saying the messages that will advance your work, you should just assume you're saying messages like, I need to escape. The other piece around the working memory is it only pays attention to what you're asking for right now. It doesn't care about your long-term goals. It doesn't care about 30 minutes from now. It wants to serve the next few seconds or minutes. So if I'm about to do an exposure and I've been trained in mindfulness and I know that that's going to be useful in that moment, I may want to say something to myself about that. It's like, okay, wait a minute. Let me step away from these thoughts. I can handle this moment. And when I say that, my working memory serves that function. So back to, I want this, right? So when I say, you know, this is hard, I don't like doing this, but I want to do this, I want to do this, then working memory calls up resources that have to do with being assertive or aggressive, if necessary, bring our fight mentality. So that's working memory. And I think we want to understand how to engage it. And I want to say one other thing around how we talk to ourselves. You know, it's all about resistance. And both of you understand that, really. That's how the disorders control us. So whatever we do, we need to learn to stop resisting. So if you move over a little bit from, I don't want to do this, maybe it's a message of, I'm willing to do this. And that sounds nice and therapeutic, but there really is a distinction between, I'm willing to do this and I want to do this. Because there's a little room to move when you say, I'm willing to do this. Like, well, I don't really want to do it, but okay, I'm willing. So I don't think I'm willing to do this is aggressive enough of a stance as I want to do this. It just sounds different. I'm willing to do this. I want to do this. And that's why I want to keep moving, pushing people in the direction of, it's a hard sell, but I want to push them in the direction of, I want this.
When you say that, I'm thinking of Rocky. And, you know, in the boxing world, when you're about to get into the ring and you don't really want to get punched, however, you actually want to win. You can't win without getting punched. So I'm just thinking about that. And I think you have an example of that in your book.
You know, I have two examples now that you say it the way you do. One is my son and daughter both got their black belts in Taekwondo, which I've never taken a martial art class in my life. But when my son was 13 or so, he was in the Junior Olympics in Taekwondo, and they compete in forms, and then they get in the ring and they compete in the ring. And I was doing a conference like this or something, and I wasn't there. So I called him that night after he competed, and I said, how'd it go, buddy? And he said, well, I lost. I said, oh, sorry. What happened? Was he like bigger than you? No, I don't think, not really. Stronger than you? I don't know. Well, what happened? Well, what happened was, as soon as the bell rang, his challenger came forward, did a roundhouse kick to Patrick's side, knocked him onto the mat. And Patrick's position at that point was, I don't want that to happen again. And so he became defensive, and he lost 7-1. Right? He was defensive and couldn't do it. So the martial arts has a motto that says, love the mat. Because you're going to end up on the mat over and over and over again. You know that just by thinking about martial arts. You get flipped and there you are. If you resist the mat, you're using up your working memory in that moment to fight against being on the mat instead of forget that. Pay attention to skills, half of which are defensive. That's one story I think about. The second one I think about is the Rumble in the Jungle a long time ago with Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. And Ali was 32 years old. Foreman was 24, 26 in his prime. Ali was on his way out. No way in the world Ali was going to win this fight. They went to Zaire. I'll say this quickly. So they trained for 3 months in Zaire. Foreman went into the jungle to be private and work on it. Ali, in between his training workouts, would go in the streets and get to know people and do his jokes and his poetry and be a smart aleck and so forth. When they got into the stadium, the entire stadium was on Ali's side. That was clever and cunning on his part. There is a rumor that his sideman, Angelo Dundee, came in the night before and loosened the ropes in the ring. So the fight begins, and Ali's been bragging that he's too fast for Foreman. Foreman is this huge, he's got the most powerful punch in heavyweight boxing. And so Ali was in the first round is kind of backing away and throwing some punches. Second round through the eighth round, he just went into the corner, brought his fists up to his face to protect his face, brought his elbows in to protect his body, and allowed Foreman to just pound away at him. Pound away. And while he was doing that, Ali was whispering in his ears, is that all you got, George? They told me you could hit, told me you could punch. By the eighth round, Foreman, who was furious at being ridiculed like that, wore himself out, and Ali knocked him out and won the competition. That's cunning. That's what we're talking about. We got to go. You don't want to go toe to toe with the content of your disorder, contamination, or thinking you ran somebody over, or suffocation when you think about the claustrophobia. You want to go cleverly. And that's part of what we're trying to talk about here. It is conniving, clever, paradoxical, and then you can win.
That's the rope-a-dope technique.
That's
right?
A rope-a-dope.
And in fact, when we are trying to face our fears, that's essentially what we're doing. That's essentially what we're teaching people to do, is you have to play rope-a-dope. You have to be able to embrace that fear and be with it and you can put your fists up and tire out the disorder, and then you throw your punch, you throw your knockout punch.
And the truth is, Ali was beaten up. He was really hurting afterwards. So you have to be willing to take the hit in mm-hmm. this work. We're not going to teach you to be so clever that you are certain of the outcome. That's the whole thing. We got some clever tricks, but you still have to step forward and take the hit, the embarrassment, the awkwardness, the clumsiness, the insecurity that comes in facing an anxiety disorder. You have to know that that's coming. You have to be willing to take that hit because there's something out there that's important to you, and that you, as I was saying before, trust that this process works.
Travel the path of least resistance and love the glove on your face.
Oh, you've got one too. That's great.
In closing here, what would you say if there was someone out there listening to this podcast who has anxiety and maybe they haven't gone to treatment yet or received any treatment? What would be your sort of words of advice or any words of guidance for them?
Listen to this podcast again. There's some great folks that you've interviewed and will continue to interview, so it's great to do that. In England, they have something that they call stepped care, and I think we're also working on that in the United States. And stepped care means that you go in and you try to intervene in a mental health disorder in the least costly way that can affect the most people. So listen to podcasts and go on websites that are authentic and valuable and study about that. And that doesn't take you in. There's books out there that you can read and learn about. And if that's not enough, see if you can find a support group to listen to. That's the next step up around that. If that's not enough, you may have to go and do some group treatment for anxiety disorders. And if that doesn't get you where you want to go to, you have to have tenacity. Keep going. Find a specialist. Sit and work with somebody even if you go in 4 or 5 sessions, you may not finish your work, but somebody who does this every day can give you in 4 or 5 sessions good guidance about what to do next. And if you have to save up some money or wait until your insurance kicks in again to go back in, you can do that too. And so that's step care. And we have lots and lots of information. That's the nice thing about the anxiety disorder. Not that many nice things about anxiety disorders, but we know how to fix anxiety disorders. There is no question about that. We are not confused about how to get better. What is hard for us to give somebody is motivation, determination, commitment, you know. So that's your side of it, is you got to go find some drive. And if you can find your internal drive, we will deliver you a treatment approach combined with that drive, and you will get stronger.
I love that. Yeah. Find some drive. I mean, if you want to run a marathon, you have to have drive to train yourself to run that marathon. And the way I think about it when you have a sufferer with an anxiety disorder is you have a long marathon to run, but you will get there. You just have to do the work.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a real honor to have you on here. And well, thank you so much for your time. And we recommend everyone check out your book, Stopping the Noise in Your Head, The New Way to Overcome Anxiety and Worry. It's a really, really great book, and you're a very good writer. And it's very easy to read and very accessible.
And we have Dr. Wilson here in the background cheering with us. Thank you so much. I so appreciate your time and your willingness to share your thoughts with our audience. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Stressless Life Podcast. You can join the discussion and find more information at thestresslesslifepodcast.com. Please write to us with questions and comments at podcast@thestresslesslife.com. Until next time, stay stressless.